Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This week on the podcast Spark and Fire, Apollo Theatre's Camilla Forbes.
I read it in one night. I felt like my heart was gutted out of my soul.
After reading Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, Camilla was determined to adapt it for the stage.
You said to me, that's not my book. That's yours now.
On Spark and Fire, creators share their stories to fuel your creativity. Spark and Fire is a Wait What original in partnership with the BBC. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.
When you meet someone online, can you trust they are who they say they are?
I keep thinking so much about you.
She's so stunning.
It's all well planned.
Love, Janessa is the true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, exploring the world of online romance scams. And it's available now. Find it wherever you found this podcast.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 1st of February, these are our main stories. The US Secretary of State, who's visiting the Middle East, has criticised some key policies of the new Israeli government, including settlement expansion. A report has found that the number of executions each year in Saudi Arabia has almost doubled under the leadership of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Hollywood actor Alec Baldwin has been formally charged with involuntary manslaughter after the fatal shooting of a cinematographer on a film set. Also in this podcast,
a pet owner took his parrot out to the park to fly around and it landed on the back of a doctor who was jogging.
But what happened next in this story from Taiwan? Find out later. We begin in the Middle East. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, has criticised several key policies of the new Israeli government during a meeting with the Palestinian President, Mahmoud Abbas. Mr. Blinken said Washington opposed actions by either side that would make a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict more difficult, including the expansion of Israeli settlements. That is one of the top priorities of Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition government, which took office in late December. Mr. Blinken said it was crucial to de-escalate and work towards a two-state solution.
It's also important to continue to strive not only for reducing violence, but ensuring that ultimately Israelis and Palestinians alike enjoy the same rights, the same opportunities. What we're seeing now for Palestinians is a shrinking horizon of hope, not an expanding one.
Our correspondent Yolan Nell spent Tuesday in the West Bank, finding out what life is like for Palestinians who've been displaced by the conflict with Israel.
Here in Jenin refugee camp, there are lots of posters of local people who've recently been killed by Israeli forces, armed fighters and civilians too. Behind me, you've got pictures of some of those who were killed in Israel's most deadly raid in the West Bank in years. That was just last Thursday. And people here celebrated the next day when a Palestinian carried out the most deadly attack on Israelis in years in a settlement in East Jerusalem. Although the US Secretary of State has come to the West Bank talking about commitment to the two-state solution, that's something that many people I've been speaking to just do not believe in anymore. It's 30 years since the Palestinians and the Israelis signed a breakthrough peace deal, but ultimately that has not led to peace, and it's not led to the creation of an independent Palestinian state. Now, when you speak to people about the Palestinian Authority leaders whom Mr. Blinken is meeting in Ramallah, people here tell me they think that they are corrupt, that they're out of touch. The Israeli military says that it comes to Jenin refugee camp repeatedly to target what it says are terrorists who are planning attacks. And certainly militant groups do have a lot of support here. They're able to tap into the sense of anger and hopelessness that many young Palestinians feel.
Yolan Nell. Now to Saudi Arabia, and despite promises of reform from the country's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, the number of executions in the kingdom has nearly doubled under the current leadership. That's according to a report by the campaign group Reprieve, shared exclusively with the BBC in advance of publication. It also found that the death penalty has been routinely used for non-lethal offences in defiance of international norms. Caroline Hawley has this special report.
This is Mustafa Al-Khayat talking to his mother from a Saudi jail. Neither had any inkling it would be the very last time they spoke. A month after the phone call and without any notice given to the family, he was put to death in the biggest mass execution in modern Saudi history, one of 81 in a single day.
Hello, guten Tag. Wir möchten bitte einen Kaffee.
His brother Yasser orders coffee at a train station in central Germany, where he now has political asylum. He fled the country fearing the same could happen to him. Mustafa, he says, took part in daily protests against the Saudi government in the east of the country before his arrest in 2014. Yasser's first visit to see him in jail a year later was a shock.
I
noticed that my brother Mustafa couldn't stand up. When we asked, he told us this was the result of torture, or rather, electric shocks.
He shows us pictures on his mobile phone of Mustafa before his arrest, a good-looking man with short hair, wearing a T-shirt. Mustafa Al-Khayat spent 8 years in jail before he and other protesters were suddenly executed, accused by the Saudi authorities of terrorism. Yasser Al-Khayat says his brother was still trying to appeal. Just 4 days after the execution, in March last year, the Saudi authorities laid on a guard of honour for the then British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He'd come to meet the Crown Prince, hoping to persuade him to pump more oil to replace Russian fuel imports. Mohammed bin Salman billed as a moderniser, but for many, a morally problematic ally. This is the prominent cleric Salman Alode talking about freedom in a YouTube video. He'd called for political reform and had millions of followers on social media before his arrest in 2017. Painted by the Saudi authorities as an extremist, prosecutors are seeking the death penalty for him. Here, his son Abdullah is looking at a Quran with him before his arrest. Abdullah, who now has asylum in the US, was a friend of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist murdered and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018.
It was horrific. We did not imagine that this government would go this far. You know, but when we saw what happened to Jamal Khashoggi 3 weeks after the beginning of my father's trial, we knew these guys were serious.
Pop out here, I can show you. This is one of the pages from the Saudi government site, the press agency, where they are saying this was an execution that took place.
Maya Foa is director of the London-based legal campaign group Reprieve. Her team have been meticulously cataloguing executions in Saudi Arabia with the help of human rights activists in exile and the country's own official announcements.
It's been a huge amount of work to gather this data, to trawl through the government websites to understand exactly who was executed and when, how they were executed, for what offences. And part of the problem is Saudi Arabia has a regime of secrecy around the death penalty. So vast numbers of the people whose cases we've now looked at, we didn't know, and our partners didn't even know they were on death row. Their family members didn't know they were executed before it happened. They found out on social media. So you have people who were arrested, tried, sentenced to death, and then executed in secret.
In response to Reprieve's findings, the Saudi embassy in London told us that many countries have the death penalty. Part of its statement is voiced by a BBC producer.
We understand that there are other countries that have different judicial systems and different views about appropriate penalties. And as we respect their right to determine their own laws and customs, we hope that others will respect our sovereign right to follow our own judicial and legislative choices.
But under international human rights law, the death penalty should be reserved for only the most serious of crimes. And campaigners say that in Saudi Arabia, it's being used against people accused of drugs offences or who were children when their alleged crimes took place.
Caroline Hawley. In the United States, the Hollywood actor Alec Baldwin has been formally charged with involuntary manslaughter for the fatal shooting of a woman on his film set. The film's armourer has also been charged with the death of cinematographer Halina Hutchins. I spoke to our correspondent Sophie Long, who's in Los Angeles. So we knew this was going to happen, but it's still a shock that one of the biggest names in Hollywood could be facing a prison sentence.
Yes, that's right. We heard last week that he, along with the armourer you mentioned there, would be formally charged with two counts of involuntary manslaughter. And those charges have now been formally filed. Now, there's quite a lot of detail. This comes, of course, after the tragic death of Halina Hutchins. She was a 42-year-old rising star in the film industry. She was fatally shot on the set of Rust in October of 2021. We've got quite a lot of detail coming out in this, but what it basically says in the statement of probable cause is that Alec Baldwin had not been properly trained ahead of the filming of this. Was a Western, so a lot of gun involvement. He had had very little training on the cross draw that he was rehearsing that day. The armourer had apparently requested that he had additional training of an hour, but that actual training consisted of just 30 minutes, according to what's being alleged in these documents. And during that training, he'd been distracted and talking on the phone to his family. Now, also, what comes out in these documents, what's being alleged by prosecutors, is that he had initially said that he fired the gun in the immediate aftermath of this tragedy. That later changed, according to these documents, and he said that he never fired the gun and it must have misfired. Well, part of the detail here is that the actual gun involved was taken to the FBI crime lab, and they've said that it wasn't a malfunctioning gun. It couldn't have misfired. So we're getting a lot of detail here, but basically it states that he was both an actor on the film and a producer. As an actor, it said that had he performed the required safety checks with the armourer, then this tragedy would not have occurred. And in addition, if Baldwin had not pointed the gun at Hutchins and at Souza, that's Joel Souza, who was the director in the film, this tragedy would never have occurred. So the details are long. It's a 10-page document, but it also states as a producer he had responsibilities as well.
And briefly, Sophie, what has Mr. Baldwin said in the past about this incident and his involvement?
Well, we've heard from his lawyers last week when we knew these charges were going to be filed, and they said that he would fight the charges and that he would win. So we've heard from him in many interviews since the tragedy when he said that he was not responsible for Halina Hutchins' death and that he was heartbroken by what had happened.
Sophie Long in Los Angeles. Ukraine has said that it will look at accusations that its military deployed landmines against Russian forces, which ended up killing civilians. As we heard in the earlier podcast, the campaign organisation Human Rights Watch claims that the mines were carried by rockets which were fired at the city of Izium whilst it was under Russian occupation. Their report noted that Russia had also deployed mines and in multiple locations, but said this did not justify Ukraine using them. The BBC correspondent Andrew Harding has been bringing us reports from the front lines in Ukraine, including the voices of the people whose lives have been affected by the war. He's just left the country at the end of his latest visit. Speaking before he left Dnipro, he said that intense fighting is still going on, but that in strategic terms, there's a pause. But, he says, it is clear that both sides are gearing up for major new offensives.
One sign we saw of that along the front line, for instance, near Bakhmut, this fiercely contested town, is the indication from soldiers, a lot of soldiers we spoke to, that the best units are not fighting here anymore. They've been pulled out, they've disappeared. Some of them may be getting rested or trained, but a lot of them, we understand, are being prepared for a new counter-offensive somewhere, perhaps further north, perhaps further south too. So I was talking to a couple of soldiers yesterday, just back from the front lines near Bakhmut, and they were saying, look, remember the Wagner group, this group of mercenaries that the Russians have been pushing in these sort of human waves against Bakhmut and Soledar, thousands of people, it seems, being killed on the Russian side, giving their lives very cheaply. Those men, it seems, to some extent, are now being pulled back, and Russian regular forces are beginning to advance. And the Ukrainian troops I was speaking to said, look, these guys are good. They are learning. They are hiding, for instance, their ammunition stores much better because these American HIMARS, these long-range, very accurate rocket systems, were destroying those stores very effectively. So the Russians are learning. They're not sending vast columns to be destroyed like in the early stages of the war last year. And that makes the focus on new weapons very important for the Ukrainians. They're all saying, we're looking forward to the tanks, But we need to up our game. We need jets. We need much longer range weapons and missiles very quickly.
Andrew Harding in Dnipro. Ukraine won the final of last year's Eurovision Song Contest just 3 months after Russia's invasion of the country. The public vote gave an overwhelming victory to the Ukrainian group the Kalush Orchestra and the song Stefania. The winner normally hosts the following year, but because of the ongoing war, the UK stepped in to hold it instead. The contest is being held in May in the city of Liverpool in northern England. On Tuesday, the city became the official host after the previous host, Turin, handed over the Eurovision keys to Liverpool's mayor. Harry Bly reports.
This was Ukraine's winning entry at the 2022 Eurovision Song Contest, held in Turin, Italy. Stefania by the Kalush Orchestra.
Winner of the Eurovision Song Contest 2022 is Ukraine!
Україна переможе Євробачення 2022!
And it's because of the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, just over 11 months since Russian forces invaded, that the keys have been handed to the United Kingdom that came second, with the northwestern English city of Liverpool, home of the Beatles, as host.
When your country is on fire, every success means a lot. Kalush Orchestra was not a performance, it was a statement.
The whole Europe could connect and give their hearts to our country. That meant so, so much.
Ukraine's Eurovision commentator Tima Miroshnitschenko and the musician Julia Sanina. For this year's contest, there are nods to last year's winner. The logo for Eurovision 2023 features Ukraine's bold flag colours, blue and yellow. And there's the slogan too, United by Music. Today, as well as Liverpool taking the reins, countries found out which semi-final they'll be in and who their rivals will be for a place in the final, which takes place on the 13th of May.
Harry Bly reporting. Still to come, we take a look at a legal challenge brought by the former wife of Elvis Presley over her daughter Lisa Marie's will.
Her will names her eldest daughter Riley as the overseer of the multi-million dollar estate, something her mother, Priscilla Presley, isn't happy about.
Stop choking Africa with economic colonialism. The scathing words of Pope Francis, aimed at wealthy nations after he arrived in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's the first pope to visit the country for almost four decades. Thousands greeted him at the airport in Kinshasa, where he was given a red carpet welcome. These people in the capital had been looking forward to the visit.
He's left home to come to us here is a joy for me. I see it as a dream come true. We waited for him last year, even though we saw he postponed it. I didn't have much hope anymore. But to see now that it happens, I'm thrilled.
When we see a great authority like the Pope come into the Congo, it shows that diplomacy is working. And as a Christian, his presence is also as a man of God. I am not a Catholic, but the presence of a man of God in the country is also a blessing. So we can only praise his presence.
Our religion editor, Ali McBall, is also in Kinshasa.
The Pope is used to the streets being lined with people, and that's exactly how it was in Kinshasa. People singing, people chanting his name, cheering as he drove past. He was, of course, sitting on a chair on his vehicle this time round, and the first image they saw of the Pope here in the Democratic Republic of Congo was him in a wheelchair. That's now how we're used to seeing the Pope. But it's been really very clear over the months in hearing the Pope that in spite of his mobility issues and the fact that he is reducing his schedule, that this was a trip that he really wanted to make. And it was pretty clear that the people here got that message too, which is why he got such a warm welcome.
And, Alim, you hinted there that he's in a country beset with problems, conflict, poverty, and the Pope had some very strong words for the outside world, particularly wealthy countries, didn't he?
Yes, he talked actually historically about the way the outside world had catastrophically had an impact on this country. He didn't directly, as it happened, mention Catholic explorers and colonizers, but he did talk of centuries of exploitation. But he said that that had given way to economic colonialism. There was a moment where he said, hands off the Democratic Republic of the Congo, hands off Africa, stop choking Africa, it's not a mine to be stripped.
And Aline, what's on his agenda during this trip?
It's an extraordinary trip in many ways. He is giving a mass here in Kinshasa. It's likely to be a full stadium, and he really comes alive, the Pope, although this speech was at the presidential palace. He comes alive in the presence of lots of people and interacting with people. But it is the second leg of the trip, which is unique, really, because he is being joined on that leg of the trip to South Sudan with other Christian leaders, the Archbishop of Canterbury, of course, head of the Church of England, and also the moderator of the Church of Scotland, with this joint peace mission to South Sudan, where you might remember leaders of that country on a two-day visit to the Vatican. At the end of that meeting, the Pope kissed their feet and asked them to move forward. Well, not a great deal has moved forward, and so this kind of ecumenical visit is to try to attempt to re-enliven a peace process there.
Ali McBull. To Egypt now, and a BBC investigation has revealed how violent criminal gangs are finding, abusing and extorting people from the LGBTQ community they meet online. The team also found that police are using dating apps to seek out and arrest LGBTQ people. This report by Ahmad Shihab El-Din, a warning that it does contain descriptions that some of you may find disturbing.
Put your hand down. If you move one bit, I'll kill you, says a voice in a clip from this disturbing video. In it, a group of five people can be seen standing in a room, naked and terrified. At times, they're beaten. At others, they're forced to dance at knife point. The video shows an attack by a gang targeting LGBTQ people in Egypt. It's one of dozens of similar attacks that our team documented during our investigation.
They were the most disgusting 6 hours of my life.
Leila was one of the people being abused in the video.
I could have died. I was scared to death.
Leila identifies as transgender. Sharing her story with us is risky, so we've changed her name for her safety. Her gender identity alone makes her vulnerable in Egypt, something the gang knew when they tried to extort her with this video.
There's no explicit law against homosexuality in Egypt, but our investigation has found that the law against debauchery, a sex work crime, is being used to criminalize the LGBTQ community. Any positive depiction of homosexuality is banned in the media. On this call-in show on state TV, the presenter tells a mother who's worried about her gay son that he needs treatment. By interviewing other victims and searching online, we were able to identify the gang leader in the viral video. We found evidence that his gang has carried out at least four similar attacks. And we discovered, to our surprise, that Yahya is himself gay and advertises his services as a sex worker online. Saeed is another victim of Yahya's gang. He's just 18. He was beaten, robbed, and filmed.
He asked for money, which I didn't have. So he called my parents, and the videos, they spread all around Egypt.
He wanted to report the attack to the police, but his lawyer advised him against it.
He said, both of you will be jailed because I'm a gay man and because he stole. He said his offense isn't as big as mine in Egyptian society.
Many we spoke to were afraid of going to the police, with some even telling us that they were arrested when they tried to report similar attacks. The BBC has been given exclusive access to police transcripts and investigation records that show exactly how they go about this. Actors have voiced one of the exchanges, which starts with the police.
Have you slept with men before?
Yes.
How about we meet?
But I live with mom and dad.
Come on, dear. Don't be shy. We can meet in public and then go to my flat.
In some of the transcripts, the police are looking for evidence of people offering sex for money, which is a crime in Egypt. but in others, there's no mention of money at all. Police forces in Egypt receive training from the UK via the UN, and the government gets billions of dollars of support from EU and US taxpayers, where LGBTQ people's rights are protected by law. The Egyptian Interior Ministry did not respond to the BBC's request for comment. Also, Yahya has denied involvement in any attacks.
Ahlan.
Hi.
I flew to Sweden to meet Leila, who's been granted asylum. But inside Egypt, Saeed and other LGBTQ people are forced to stay hidden or face the potential consequences.
That report by Ahmad Shihab El-Din. The former wife of the American singer Elvis Presley has begun a legal challenge over her daughter's will. Lisa Marie Presley died suddenly 2 weeks ago at the age of 54, leaving control of her estate and finances to her eldest daughter. This report from Charlotte Gallagher.
Good evening. Elvis Presley died today. He was 42. Apparently it was a heart attack.
Elvis and Priscilla Presley were already divorced when he died in 1977, so his daughter Lisa Marie became the heir to his fortune, an estimated $100 million. It's been widely reported that Lisa Marie had financial issues in recent years, but it's thought she still had a considerable amount of money. She also owned Elvis Presley's famous Graceland Mansion, now a successful tourist attraction. Her will names her eldest daughter, Riley, as the overseer of the multi-million dollar estate, something her mother, Priscilla Presley, isn't happy about. Priscilla is challenging the authenticity and validity of the document. She says a 2016 amendment that replaced her as a trustee is suspicious because the spelling of her name is wrong and one signature appears unusual. Priscilla Presley's lawyer is asking a judge to rule the change invalid, returning her to position of trustee in charge of her daughter's assets. Jeremy Heliger, who's the executive editor of People magazine, isn't surprised by what's happened.
Now, the interesting part of this story is that Lisa Marie and Priscilla did not have a relationship at the time of Lisa Marie's death. They had a very frosty relationship for the past 6 or 7 years.
An unnamed friend of Lisa Marie Presley told NBC News the legal action by Priscilla was, in their words, a money grab, adding that Lisa Marie had been very clear what she wanted.
Charlotte Gallagher. And finally, normally when pet owners get into trouble, it's likely to be because their dogs have got out of control. But what about when your pet bird goes rogue instead? Well, the owner of a macaw, a large multicoloured parrot in Taiwan, has ended up with a 2-month prison sentence and a huge fine after his bird tangled with someone in a park. Kerry Allen told me what happened.
A pet owner took his parrot out to the park to fly around and it landed on the back of a doctor who was jogging and started flapping its wings. And the doctor panicked, wondered what on earth was happening, and he fell over. And he dislocated his hip joint and sustained a fracture to his pelvis. What happened next was that he decided to sue the owner because he wasn't able to work for over 6 months.
And so he sued him and it became a criminal case, not a civil case, because this person has now been convicted and the owner is going to spend some time in prison.
He is going to spend 2 months in prison and he's been fined a whopping $91,000 because the size of the bird is 40 centimetres in height, 60 centimetres wingspan. It's classed as a large animal. So the owner has been told that he should have taken protective measures before taking the bird out to fly around.
And is it quite common for people to have these kind of pets, massive great birds like that?
Well, Taiwan does have huge pet ownership. In fact, there have been reports suggesting that people have as many pets as children in Taiwan. They're very popular and you do see people with macaws in Taiwan. But the court has even acknowledged that this is a very rare incident. They've never seen anything like this in the last decade, a case where a macaw could actually attack somebody. And this is actually making up part of the pet owner's appeal. He's saying that his macaws are not aggressive And he feels that the compensation is too high because the macaw could have attacked anyone. But because the doctor, who's a plastic surgeon, has a high salary and his work involves standing for a long period of time, this has obviously affected him being able to do his job.
How people reacted to this in Taiwan? Sympathy for the pet owner or sympathy for the person who was attacked by it?
I think there's a lot of surprise in general, just the fact that this is a very unusual case. So it's widely covered today in Taiwanese media. Lots of talk about this. And, yeah, questions about what might happen next.
Kerry Allen. That's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Stuart Willey. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.
More stories.
I've only known chaos and conflict. The war was actively going on when I was growing up.
And more African voices.
If you take away a man's identity, you take away somebody's own self-esteem.
The Comb is back.
This is The Comb.
Need The Comb.
The Comb.
Shining a light on the stories that matter from across the African continent. Each week we dive into a single topic and explore the story further. Speaking to the people who are living it.
You wake up and you hear the announcement that the camp must close. You see that your life is very uncertain.
They told me that the people who worship the local gods, they are meant to go to hellfire.
I didn't understand what I was feeling. I didn't know what I was going through.
That's The Comb from the BBC World Service.
The Comb.
Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Sporting great, Ora Washington.
Who was Ora Washington?
A born competitor. Ora was champion in two sports.
She was the Michael Jordan of women's basketball.
She was a tennis champion.
But while she was fighting for titles on the courts, she was facing prejudice off them.
The reason is racism and sexism.
Untold Legends, Ora, a podcast from the BBC World Service and BBC Sounds, tells her remarkable story. Search for Untold Legends wherever you found this podcast.